I'm very happy to have Ben and Josh here tonight. Ben Berman is going to read first so he can read long, according to Josh. Ben Berman's first book, Strange Borderlands, won the 2014 Peace Corps Award for Best Book of Poetry and was a finalist for the Massachusetts Book Awards. His second collection, Figuring in the Figure, is recently out from Able Muse Press. He has received awards from the New England Poetry Club and fellowships from the Massachusetts Cultural Council and the Somerville Arts Council. He is a poetry editor at Solstice Literary Magazine and teaches in the Boston area where he lives with his wife and daughters. Ben Berman.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be out here. And so excited to be reading with Josh, too. I'm going to start with a few poems from my first book. It's called Strange Borderlands. And it mostly chronicles my time as a Peace Corps volunteer in Zimbabwe, where I was in the late 90s. First poem is going to be called Learning Shona. Shona was the language that I learned to speak out there, and I got pretty good at it for the most part. But about 3 months into our trainings, we had these interviews where our Shona teacher spoke to us just in Shona in front of 60 other Shona teachers. And mine was going swimmingly until my teacher said to me, he said, "Unuyetene Shondo." And for some reason, 3 months in, I didn't know the word Shondo meant Sunday, but I knew the word Shondo meant foreskin. So he had asked me, "What did you do on your Sundays?" And I thought he said, "What did you do with your foreskin?" So I repeated to him, "Dino tiene Shondo?" And he said, "Hey, uno tiene Shondo." So using my 3 months of broken Shona skills, I tried to explain the Jewish ritual of circumcision. This poem is called Learning Shona. At first, there were the obvious slips of similarly spelled words, penis and pumpkin leaves, Sunday and foreskin. I learned to pray and with ass sound almost exactly the same. And it wasn't just language either. I'd see a man suffering gum disease and write home about the beautiful, toothless smiles. The same day, I waved back to a group of men, not knowing the opposition had claimed the open-hand salute. I confused a woman with a room, announced, "Excuse me, but I'd like to enter you," as I tried to squeeze by. The village idiot was a giant mute, the one man in a 100-mile radius that I could outspeak, and even he mocked me. Would carve UK into his forearm and point emphatically. If words are, as Gary Snyder writes, rocky surefoot trails, I was learning to uproot paths for artillery, pelt iwes at the children tugging me for sweets, futseke wakos at the urchins high off hot glue. But Zimbabwe means the house of stones, and I was getting grittier by the day, gritting my teeth, and studying how to sharpen a knife on a slate, build a ramp and push a car out of the mud. Eventually, I'd be fluent enough to sling a bird out of a tree, contain a fire, line a grave so water couldn't leak in. So I was a vegetarian for a number of years before I went to the Peace Corps, but I decided once I got there that I wanted to start raising my own animals and slaughtering them and preparing them. And it turns out that I'm really bad at killing chickens in particular. I'm a little bit squeamish and I don't have great hand-eye coordination. And the first one I tried to kill, there was this group of 10-year-old girls who were responsible for killing all these chickens when the ministry was coming. I decided I wanted to help, so they gave me a knife and sort of showed me the technique. Problem was that the knife was about as dull as a spoon, and so I sat there just sort of sawing away at the chicken's head and sawing, and nothing was happening, and I started panicking a little bit as all these little girls were laughing at me. And before I knew it, I'd pulled so hard that my left hand had sort of torn his face off of his neck. And it was this awful, bloody, horrible thing. So I wrote a sonnet about it. It's called Killing the Chicken with a Dull Knife. And just a couple poetry quotes, if you don't know them. William Carlos Williams famously said, "There are no ideas but in things." And Emily Dickinson called hope the thing with feathers. Killing the chicken with a dull knife. Like a boy learning the cello, I bowed his neck back and forth, praying that his skin would nick soon. But with each stroke came errant notes and straying squalls, some high-pitched staccato squawks that sounded nothing like concerto in D major. And like the boy who spends hours practicing for his big performance, then stands in front of everyone and still chokes, I too began choking with my bare hands until his face slid off his throat. And as I stared at his legs convulsing, I thought, if there are no ideas but in things, please let this bloody thing with feathers be ruin or flippancy, anything but hope. So I knew when I was going out to the Peace Corps that there'd be a lot of things that would be hard. No running water, no electricity, being away from my family for a few years. But a lot of the things that were actually much more difficult, no one really prepares you for. So for me, I was sort of relentlessly bullied for the first few months that I was there by this pack of three-year-old boys that were absolutely horrible. They would stand outside my classroom door every time I would teach, throwing rocks at me, and they would scream, "Murungu wakashata murungu," which means, "White man, you are ugly white man." And there was this stick in the classroom that you could use to beat the students. And one day I picked it up and threatened to hit all these three-year-old boys. And they went diving into this flock of goats that, for me, were always this very otherworldly thing. And I realized just how much of a freak I was to them. That to me, these goats were like these really strange, bizarre-looking things. But to them, that was what I was. So this is called "To the Safety of Goats." Kids used to throw rocks at my window and shout, "Wakashata," then run away to the safety of goats. A goat screams like a man when you kill him. An ox will stare you down. Tie him to a tree and take an axe to his neck, and he'll snort and kick a leg, look you straight in the eye. One time a rooster fell down the outhouse. You couldn't piss without hearing him cock and doodle-doo until Marweezy doused him in kerosene and lit him on fire. For a month, the entire compound smelled like roast chicken. That was before the kerosene ran low and the wood got wet, and we had to eat dried goat meat and raw sweet potatoes for 3 days straight. You could barely chew goat dried, but at least it was meat. At least it wasn't the boiled lung or intestine or cartilage they'd serve when the ministry visited. During termite season, we'd sit outside with a candle and glass of water, pull their wings off, drown them, then fry them in a pan. Kids would pack their pockets full and come to class with little V-shaped legs stuck between their teeth. Better that, though, than dried maize and beans, farting and giggling and blaming the girls. I ate grasshoppers on a dare, cockroaches to be polite, and a rock off a fruit stand, only to find out later that it was meant for pregnant women. Mavinduzzi used to tell me that I drank like a pregnant woman. He'd grab my collar and announce that I was Ungochani, threaten me until I opened my lips to the bucket of beer, until I could move outside to the safety of braai, the familiar smell of searing meat, Makwesha asking me to pass the salt. All right, I'm going to read some from my newer book. It's called Figuring in the Figure, and it's a much more domestic book. It sort of looks at what it was like to come home and sort of settle into the domestic life. I have a 6-year-old and a 4-year-old, now 2 young daughters, but much of the book was written when my older daughter was an infant, and sort of culminates with following her birth up to her being 1.5 or so. So the first poem I'm going to read is called "Droppings." We had a mouse problem in our house for a little bit now, and not also the greatest with killing mice. We got a bunch of traps that, like, aren't supposed to kill them, or, like, supposed to be humane, but they just chew right through them. So my best strategy so far has just been pure denial. So this poem's called Dropping. It might be the crumbled ash from a match, I tell myself, or toasted seed from a loaf of multigrain bread. But my stomach seems to already know that there is life behind the walls. Something about the pinched ends. No different, say, than the slightest lift in my wife's voice. That imperfect pitch that tells me she's upset long before she tells me she's upset. And it's always when speech and language are barely a tail's length apart that we dwell on those gaps and what's behind them. Each tiny trail leading to something just out of our grasp. This next one's called After the Epiphany. And there was this movie in the 90s called Sweet Home Alabama. It was a pretty awful movie, but it starred Reese Witherspoon, so I really liked it. And in the movie, they're walking on this beach in Alabama, and they find all these beautiful, they're called fulgurites, these beautiful figurines, and they tell each other that lightning just struck the sand and it just magically appeared. And for a long time, I sort of thought the creative process would work like that. So it's been many years of standing in rainstorms waiting for lightning, as Randall Jarrell said. It's called After the Epiphany. In the movie, a streak of lightning transformed the sand into delicate glass figurines, as though all it takes is a thunderstorm. As though all that intricate filigree adorning the glass was the mere result of some sudden flash. But real fulgurites, it turns out, look more like mangled roots, opaque and grainy, about as glamorous as their name. Not to praise the realists who see the light but speak only of glares, wander through this world without wonder. But how often we see things as clear as glass, then crash like birds into some window. So 3 days after I came home from the Peace Corps, I decided to run the Maine Marathon. I hadn't really been training for the marathon. I'd been running a lot, but I hadn't really been training. But my dad had been sick with cancer, and he was going to walk it. My brother said, why don't we run it? So I was like, all right. But around mile 12, he pulled out with a hamstring injury. So I kept finding all these other people to run with. And at mile 20, I found this, much older at the time, it's probably my age now, but much bigger guy. And I was running with him, and I was like, you know, I feel really great for having just run 20 miles. And he looked at me with the most condescending stare ever, and he said, son, you're only halfway there. It's called grit theory. We tried counting steps and adjusting our form, closing our eyes and pretending the ground was the ocean, and we were flakes of foam. We chanted our mantras, grunted and groaned, convinced ourselves blisters were first world problems, and that grit would come from the grind. But by mile 20, we'd hit a brick wall, found ourselves running on mortared joints, learned just how quickly a hardened will can transform into a rigid won't. All right, so I'm going to read just a few more poems about the birth of my daughter, my older daughter. All right, so the first one's called After Installing the Safety Gate. So I am not the most handy person in the world, and that brings a great deal of shame to me. And having a baby required all of this handiness that I just didn't have, and it was really embarrassing. There's something about my manhood that I felt was being challenged again and again. So I originally I titled this poem, The Opposite of DIY is Yid. But my brother's a rabbi, so I figured I couldn't get away with using the word Yid in the title of a poem. So now it's just called After Installing the Safety Gate. A single screw pokes out of the wall like a tiny erection. Stripped so hard, all we can do is hope that it will fall out on its own. Its slotted head smiling like some obnoxious clown. So now I too feel stripped. My manhood uncloaked in yet another unclean finish to a project, as though I'll always be the wandering, eccentric uncle of my own home. The shame of my halfway commitments exposed in the front hallway. All right, so this next one's called, I'll do two more. This next one's called Roots and Wings. And so when my wife was breastfeeding our child, our daughter, I was really interested in all the language that came with sort of being a parent. There were all these words that were suddenly used in different ways. And in particular, when the milk would come down, it was called a letdown, right? And when the milk would come out, it's called self-expression. And I was really jealous of that because as a poet, I was all about letdowns and self-expression. And here my wife was using it to feed our baby, and I was just using mine to articulate my loneliness in clever ways. So it was really depressing. So it's called Roots and Wings, and it starts with a quote by Hodding Carter. It says, "There are only two lasting bequests we can hope to give our children. One of these is roots, the other wings. You can only hush and hum for so long, rock and cradle so much, before you're ready to admit that your newborn's not nuzzling into your chest, but rooting at your dry nipple. Before you reluctantly pass her to your wife and take over the laundry, wondering what it would be like to express your letdowns, to just let them flow freely from your body, instead of all the repressed whimpers you make when your daughter falls asleep and you step on those wind-up, chattering teeth and have to flail about like an upturned tree in the wind. Your roots flapping so hard, they look like wings." All right, so this final poem, I didn't realize until I started doing readings how much I was just writing about how inadequate I am as a parent in every poem. But I am not a picture-taking person, or father in particular. I don't own a camera. I don't own the kind of phone that takes pictures. But when my daughter was about 9 months old, she had her first solid poop. And I turned to my wife, and I was like, "We should take a picture." And she looked at me like an idiot. And she was like, "After 9 months, this is the first picture you want to take?" And I was like, "Yeah, we'll send it to your Uncle Mark. It will be great." So I wrote this poem to sort of figure out why I wanted to take a picture. It was called "A Familiar Form." We'd hope that some tiny bits of solid food would lead to a solid night's rest, deliver us from the piles of soiled onesies. But mixed fruits had mixed results. Ground meat always wound up on the ground, and she somehow mistook chunks of roasted squash for miniature hand grenades. She'd protest the texture, reject the flavor, or simply start gagging, and all our grand dreams of order would come crashing to the floor. Which is why we almost started to rejoice when, changing her, we found a familiar form, like umeboshi on a bed of rice, with its perfect sense of calm and grace. Thank you.
Joshua Scott Fishburne is a graduate of the Seattle Pacific MFA program and has taught creative writing and humanities for 9 years. He is an annual participant in the New England Young Writers Conference in Bredlow, Vermont, teaches a craft-based and workshop-oriented personal essay course every summer, and enjoys writing each week with the Gloucester-based Ward 3 Writers Group. In June, he included a chapbook of poems, Weather Report, in the show Resist, The Art of Protest, curated by Amanda Cook, and Stevens Brosnahan. His work has appeared in Le Temps Retrouve. I am inadequate at pronouncing things. The Journal of Waring School. Joshua is on the board of the Gloucester Writers' Center. He lives in Gloucester with his three amazing young children and Rosemary Scott Fishburne, a fantastic visual artist and photographer. She is.
It's amazing to be in such incredible kind of sympathetic company as a parent of young children. And I don't know how far back that is for you. For me, it's present. It's the present reality. So I felt like you were narrating events of my week, my day, my life. And I'm touched and moved by the movements you expressed. So I think it was, correct me if I'm wrong, was it Richard Hugo who said there's public poets and private poets? Is that true? I think he did. And some people just are one, and some people just are another way. I was challenged by this, by the events of, mainly because of the events of the election of 2016, to try to write some public poetry as a way of processing what life is like right now in, as an American citizen. And so I was really glad to have this opportunity to process things publicly on a sabbatical from teaching for a semester, and during which I kind of collected some neighbors and friends. Craig is here from my Ward 3 writing group. I think Gloucester has 6 wards now. Is that true? Or 7? 5, really? Is that true?
Well, there are subdivisions within the wards.
Okay. I didn't realize that. So anyway, so a lot of these poems came from this challenge to write something that was public, or at least, you know, I don't want to say political, but because they're not really political in the sense, maybe they are in the sense of Henry's film Paulus, but I don't know. So the first 4 poems I'm going to read, I think, are from that experience. And then maybe I'll finish up with some that are personally reflective of my experience living in Gloucester and commuting every day and living in a home here in Gloucester and thinking about domestic stuff. So to move to the private. The first one is called Weather Report. Tree sticks will claw the air and rattle. Gusts will pick up trash, and it will flutter and shred above in branches like prayer flags from Sikkim, but different. Scuttling and scraping recyclables will emigrate down asphalt and concrete to the beach. Recyclables will reach the harbor where day after day they will alternately collect, float, collect, then submerge partway down the water column. Each day, sun will chisel water with cuts that reject the sky. People will drive cars over and kick away empties from the sidewalk. These events may or may not diminish what life lives here in Gloucester Town. This is a poem called Ward 3, Gloucester, Massachusetts, and this is with acknowledgement to James Wright, who wrote a poem called Autumn Comes to Martin's Ferry, Ohio. Ward 3, Gloucester, Massachusetts. I deliver poems to doorsteps for several friends. It is the night of Super Bowl, the final ritual of a season of terrible galloping of men against each other's bodies. Look west over the river. The moon. But listen, women and men of Gloucester groan in front of TVs on Lookout Street, behind house walls, affirming that which moves on the screen and sighing loud and shouting, yes, and all right. One poem reads, lonely little question mark. Another, don't you know it's not nice to be naked? And another, better live free than die slaves, Langston Hughes gets the essence of life in America. But bidden by the love and hatred mingling in my city, Ingrid Bergman remembers herself to my mind to tell Bogey once again about the dissonant tone love makes in crumbling times as far-right extremists invade her city of love. Darkness between the stars comes close to earth and seduces me. Rooftops and windows, casements shimmer. The bright moon entwines fingers with the river. Does it matter what all the sounds of affection are for? Excited moans from people shut up together or alone make the moon, the hilltop, the street, a disinterested audience. I place poems in envelopes under bricks atop porches. Again, Ingrid's voice, with the whole world crumbling, we pick this time to fall in love. As in Gloucester, women and men make love with terrible violence on the same channel, shouting yes and exhaling in sheer relief under this February moon. Tomorrow, the light bulb trailer in the rotary will read, "Greatest Comeback Ever." But tonight the moon shouts, "Make love! I'm making love!" Tomorrow morning, perhaps Gloucester will remember something like making love to something. And forgetting the salacious night, the moon over the river, the harbor, all seven steeples that point in hope and expectation toward the sky, will proceed to announce what is truly, utterly unforgettable. I don't know if you all remember the news about the baseball player Adam Jones this last spring at Fenway Park. Do you remember that, Paul? I don't know if you follow the Sox. No. All right. I know, but I didn't know if you followed the Sox. So Adam Jones was a ball player who was a couple of Red Sox fans were in the stands, and he's in the outfield, and they were shouting racist slurs at him, and they got ejected from the game. These guys, but the response from the Red Sox franchise was rather slow to this event, and it got me starting to think. This poem is called "Our Local and National Pastime is Corruption," and there's two epigraphs for the poem. The first is from "The Road to Segregation," which is from the Massachusetts Advisory Committee to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights in 1975. And then the second epigraph is from "An Account of Two Voyages to New England" by John Jocelyn, 1674. So the first epigraph reads, "The cities and towns along the 128 perimeter are most deeply indebted to the federal government for their suburban quality. They are also indebted to it for the preservation of their all-white character." And in 1674, John Jocelyn wrote, "They told me of a sea serpent or snake that lay coiled up like a cable upon a rock at Cape Ann." Gloucester made its wealth and reputation selling cod flesh dried and salted, framed on flake racks, sold to stave off starvation on plantations during 300 years of Holocaust of slave labor camps we call the Beautiful South. This is our history, our cities, and our nations. In our bourgeois dream, we don't own slaves, but live in comfort because other people do, and because we did once upon a time. Now we say, how horrible! We stand with everyone else at Fenway Park to applaud Adam Jones, one of the 62 black baseball players in the major leagues, population 868, who on May 1st, 2017, during a performance of our national pastime, was called a nigger by people who look, dress, eat, drink, shit, wipe, wash, and talk just like us. Gloucester, remember the old Moose Lodge on Pleasant Street? It used to host a slave auction, but we don't like to remember that. And so the historical museum tore it down and made a strange garden that memorializes something indefinite, making no mention of the past, thereby avoiding the present, like the standing ovation we dedicate to Adam Jones. For what? As we try to forget by disassociating ourselves from the evil that troubles the waters of our harbor, troubles the road we drive to get here, to leave here, the way we always have been, are now, and always will remain, should we continue to follow these scripts, play this charade. And this, I'm going to probably read three more. So this is the last one of those attempts at writing public poems. This is called, this title is called The River Shines Forth, Really Shimmers Forth, As If Water Is the True Surface of the Earth, Not Land, Prostrate Under the Sun, and the Cloud Ceiling Mirrors Brightness Down to Irradiate the Shadow City of Gloucester.
Is that the longest title on record?
I don't know. Is it? It was all I could think of. Stand with me. Imagine this town, Gloucester, open to fields and river, smokeless, like what Wordsworth saw from Westminster Bridge. Now see it for the American hardscape it has become. For all the forsythia blooming in the hide and shit corner of Governor's Park, in spite of the soft petals of the pink dogwood beside the old Bragg's place, even though the sunlit west and the darkened east make the aluminum steeple of St. Anne's look like a fired homing beacon, we must shout, "Don't touch that!" to our kids as they reach towards the empty syringes on the sidewalk and wonder at the used condoms on Summer Street. But this light, it provokes the imagination. In moments, the dark east is transformed. Good Harbor lurks like a frontier beyond the lapis carillon towers of Our Lady of Good Voyage. The light reflects the west. The river reflects upward, and we can once again recall the brown god, the great intractable god the river has always been, is now and ever shall be before any shadows beguiling fell upon this place. I guess that's a shout out to T.S. Eliot at the end. I should acknowledge that. Not, I guess. yeah. So for a long time, I was on the same train every morning going to Beverly, and left at 6:05. And for most of the year, I'd get to watch the sunrise over the Annisquam from the train window as we went across the causeway. And it was always this moment for me. It has been for, you know, going on a decade now, this moment of a last look at Gloucester before it disappears into the trees, but, you know, beside Mill Pond. And so I did write a couple of train poems about that experience. This is one of them. And I guess it goes to a couple of different geographical locations. I'm from California, and so the landscape of Gloucester and the Atlantic seaboard sort of shifts in my mind to what I remember and what I recall instinctively from my childhood growing up at Big Sur. So for a while, going over the causeway, looking at the sunrise, got me thinking about being on the West Coast and looking at the sunset. And I started contemplating themes of lost and found, alienation from homelands, and this kind of thing. At sunrise in the train over the causeway at Dunfudgeon, every weekday morning for 7 years, considering the tide and hummocks of the marsh down the long sky above the river for 3 seasons, the sky in all weather, rocking in the seat in the front car rolling away from Gloucester, I find myself again lost. Found is facing a cow skull desiccated on a hillside half a mile above the western sea. while a hawk heats outstretched wings and oak trees filter shards of fog through sunlit fingers, the ocean wearing fog and mumbling, and turning towards the muttering cloud, I see my shadow, nimbus ringed and luminous, wearing a rainbow for a crown. But in Gloucester, I know I'm lost because the marsh curves and mud slump, ocean current and driftwood don't pull me the way they did when I imagined the river at low tide, smelling naked like sweat, and I believed, no, imagined, God must taste like salt, smell like fish, feel like bird shit in the face, in the wet breeze blowing cold. Wonder, or at least its indications, used to pull me without asking, without me asking, as when in the west at San Simeon, a humpback whale, or maybe two, spike the water under the brine just beyond the surf line, spy hop, breach, and roll black with barnacles chasing anchovies, shimmering like star fields for food. And we watch these whales, my daughter and I, on the steep shore, before walking through eucalyptus trees to the bluff to look for more whales in a purple sea. I receive the mass of the whale above the water, the shimmer of the anchovy cosmos, and the network of inspiration, hope, and wonder seems complete. This is recognizable, an event like going to the altar rail at a church to receive a mystery. But now the sunrise in the east offers me no hope. The marsh is merely mud, the trash that hangs at the high tide mark, trash. The sea, big or little, I try to care, but big or little, it's just always there. The sky, too, just there. And the network within a tangled wood, the good so hard to find. And wonder, just a job I go to on a train each morning. Every morning, over the causeway at Dunfudgeon. I don't know, did you know it's called Dunfudgeon, right? I love that name. It's Dunfudgeon because it's the point where the tide comes into the river. And back in the days when they used to harvest salt marsh hay on barges, it was the point where it was deep enough for them not to have to pull through the muck because they would float. It's nice to get carried out of town on that. This is the last poem I'm going to read. And this is another, this is a poem about domestic life. And ruminating about, well, I guess you'll see. It's called A Plea for Transformation. The size of the truck, something about driving, and this woman who is my wife turns away from the cast iron skillet where chicken thighs brown and smoke pulls through the ventilating fan to tell me, I would never say that to a man. To remind me, she is my equal in all things. Maybe our experience is different, but ability is even different than that, and don't I dare try to refute it. It's true. 15 minutes later, she backs the Ram 1500 into the afternoon dark as night with wind tearing at the pavement with rain lining down and drives beyond Providence. She loads it up and tarps it down, bed filled fast to beat the hail, pees in the Rhode Island woods and drives home in thunder and lightning and time to console both crying children and nurse the youngest down to sleep. Standing, still by the kitchen sink, under the doctor's orders not to lift anything heavier than a jug of milk, I catch the drift of my prejudice, if not the extent, the corners of my assumptions lifted. In this case, as in all others, facing the unknown requires enough intelligence to not assume I know what I do not know, to work and think like she does, ceaselessly, by flashes of light in the dark, no matter the distance or the task. Thanks.
was nice.